Last evening, Father Kinney told me that he was going to introduce me, and I said, it's easy. Just get up and tell him a pack of lies. The biggest lie that he told you was about my being an outstanding authority. I'm not an outstanding authority. Before you go home after listening to me, you will know that perfectly well. I am so grateful to God that he allows me to be here. This is, stand up here and look out at the sea of faces here, to celebrate the centenary of St. Therese is a thrill. Didn't God give us a beautiful day? Wasn't he most thoughtful to put those mountains over there so we could look at them? We should see the sun shining. It's all evocative of the marvelous spirit of the woman that I would like to talk about to you now. The title of the talk is The Saint for Me. May I start with a phrase that is used far too often. Please bear with me. Bear with me if this talk seems a little over personal. The title should have given you warning. It was listed. The Saint for Me. I first read the autobiography of St. Therese when I was 20 years old. In my first year in the seminary, the year was 1939. You can figure out that that birthday, March 8th, is my 78th, if you're good at arithmetic. I still recall my initial reaction to reading the autobiography. Some people are turned off the first time they read it. I was completely turned on with immense joy and a great feeling of relief. I had found at last a saint who spoke to me. To my deep personal need. I knew, of course, that if I was going to be a priest, I needed to be a spiritual man. But how? Therese placed spirituality within my reach in a way that I had never experienced that before. She made it feasible. Saints had always intimidated me. And to that extent, they discouraged me. Because I could never be like them. Therese did not intimidate me. She only made me want to know her better. I finished The Story of a Soul. I closed the book. And I said, this is the saint for me. I think I realized even then, way back in 1939, when I was a young fellow, that no saint would ever take her place. With allowances for ups and downs, of which life is full, intervals when I pursued her less ardently than at other times. She has been a constant companion to me during the 58 years since 1939. An abiding presence who grows more present as the years go by. Now that I'm going down what has to be the home stretch of my life, I am able to say that she makes my old age delightful. She who died so young, at 24, makes me see that the later years of life are the better ones. You young people out there. believe me, the best years of life lie ahead of you. And if you're lucky enough, that is, to get to be old. Not a day goes by that I don't pray to Saint Therese. And it doesn't seem like praying at all. It's almost not religious. It's just talking to a friend. Her picture hangs on my wall in that lovely photograph out of which she looks straight into your eyes. That's my favorite one. Taken, I believe, when she was 22 and still in good health. She looks so fine in her Carmelite habit. I know a photograph is just a chemical illusion on a piece of sensitized paper. But I'm foolish enough to think that's herself. And at odd moments, I glance up for a look at her. And there she is, looking at me. All the time, looking at me, even when I don't look at her. I often ask her for help. I never step into a pulpit without invoking her. Just before starting this talk, I begged her to make it halfway decent. She has done me more favors than I could ever count. Brought me through some tough times of stress. Helped me especially during one hard stretch when I feared that I was going to have a nervous breakdown. And done for me those 1,000 trifling favors that she does for millions of other people, like finding things I've misplaced in my room. And the older you get, the more you misplace them. You get out of your chair to get something across the room, and when you're halfway across the room, you can't remember why you got out of your chair. Finding me parking spaces on the crowded streets of New York. She has even, will you believe it, sent me roses. I'm almost embarrassed to say that. It seems such a silly thing for a grown man to be talking about getting roses. Yet I feel sure that although somebody else bought them, it was she who sent them. Just as surely as if her name were on the card that the florist put with them. And that is a bit silly, I suppose. Scripted and beautifully framed on a table near the door of my room, I have words which she wrote to Maurice Bellier, a man in whom I have a great interest because I'm writing a book about Maurice and Therese. It's got a wow of a title. Maurice and Therese, the story of a love. They'll pick it up in the airport. These are the words that she wrote to Maurice that I have in that little frame. I am your sister and your friend. And I will always watch over you. I believe that she meant them for me just as much as she meant them for him. I believe she would say those words to anyone who would like to hear her say them. She is the friendliest of saints. She never places excessive demands upon you. Never says you have to do this or you have to do that. You don't have to do anything. She just says, I'm your sister and your friend, and I'll always watch over you. But it is not for favors, big ones and small ones, that I love her. I love her because over a long time she has taken me seriously. And by taking me seriously, she has helped me to take myself seriously. She has made me understand, and I trust you will not think this pretentious, that my most treasured human right is the right to want to be holy. The right to want to be pleasing to God. She makes me feel sure that I'm not kidding myself when I say I do want that. So do you want it. Or you wouldn't be here. She has, if I may put it this way, enabled me to believe in my own sincerity. You have to believe in your own sincerity. My friends, we all have to believe in our own sincerity. Therese has never let me doubt mine. Because she treats me as one who she believes is sincere. I hope you don't mind my being so personal. But how can anybody who knows Therese at all speak about her impersonally? I shall not get so personal as to make a public confession to you. What I have done in my life is between me and my confessor. Or I should use the plural, my confessors, because not one of them has the whole sad story. But I can tell you, in the privacy of this meeting, that my life has not qualified me to stand before the world as a paragon of virtue. This has never seemed to bother Therese. It did not bother her that her beloved brother Maurice had many sins in his past that worried him terribly. There was one sin that he committed in the army during his year of military service for which he had to leave the seminary. The law of France was you had to serve a year in the army when you reached a certain age. And this was after Therese had been assigned to pray for his vocation. A sin that he never identified for her, except to call it la plus belle sottise, the worst blunder of all. It tortured his conscience, and it made him wince with shame. He wrote her that his year in the army was a disaster. He said, being a soldier was not very good for being a seminarian. I committed unheard of blunders. And that worst blunder of all. She never showed the slightest curiosity to know what it was, nor what any of the blunders were. She just told them to stop worrying about them and to cast them into the red hot fire of mercy that burns in the heart of God, to be forgiven and forgotten and destroyed. Some of us have sins that we wince to remember. In any case, we all have a generous dose of, let's call it, mediocrity. She teaches us not to waste time feeling bad about not being better than we are. Because she places little store on excellence. On what we used to call, quotes, perfection. Back in the old days, before she opened our eyes to the full meaning of God's merciful love. Her sister Marie received a letter from Thérèse written while she was making her last private retreat in September of 1896, which has been incorporated into her autobiography as Manuscript B. It is 12 pages long, and it is the gem set in the center of the story of a soul, and is reckoned to be one of the greatest pieces of religious literature that has ever been penned. Marie replied that she rejoiced in all the holy desires and virtuous aspirations which her young sister was experiencing in her life, and especially on that retreat. But she told Thérèse that what she had written had saddened her, because she, Marie, had no such holy desires. For example, the desire to be a martyr. She said, I don't want to be a martyr. I have more suffering than I can take right now, and I'm not looking for any more. So how could she love God, she asked, the way Thérèse did? And this is what Thérèse wrote back the next day, on September 17th, 1896. How can you ask me if it's possible for you to love God as I love Him? Let me tell you that my desires for martyrdom are nothing. She underlines nothing. They are not what give me the unlimited confidence I feel in my heart. They are not what pleases God in my little soul. What pleases Him is to see me loving my littleness and my poverty, and the blind hope I have in His mercy. This is my only treasure. Why should it not be yours? The more one is weak, without desires and without virtues, the more one is suited for the operations of His consuming and transforming love. It is confidence and nothing but confidence that must lead us to love. At the end of the letter, Thérèse added, with a mixture of irony and impatience, but mostly, I think, with a touch of humor which tries to pull Marie out of the dumps, "My dear little sister, if you don't understand what I have said to you, it is because you are too great a soul. Take that, Marie, and figure it out." That letter of September 17, 1896 goes right to the heart of Thérèse's deepest insight into God and into the mystery of His merciful love. Her words should be engraved upon our hearts and memorized and never forgotten. If we really understand and believe what they say, then we know what the little way means. And we will have no difficulty in following it. It can be extremely difficult to strive for perfection in virtue, and in plain fact, we can never attain it. The quest is hopeless. That's why the sacrament of penance is repeatable. But what is impossible for you or for me? What is impossible about striving for total confidence in God's merciful love? Which is the one thing we all want, and which puts the whole onus on God and not upon ourselves. This gets the monkey of perfection off our back. There is, after all, no way that we can save ourselves, so it's a waste of time to try. The onus for our salvation is on God, and He has rested it upon the broad and brave shoulders of His Son Jesus, who died on the cross with all those sins. Of course, we must not give the impression that Therese condones or encourages mediocrity, no more than she suffers fools. She was tough with the novices. She went after them with a no-nonsense attitude about their carelessness, and she unmasked mercilessly the neurotic sensitivities behind which some of them tried to hide. We're all neurotics. Life must be a constant effort, in Therese's view, to grow in God's love. But the more we come to trust in His mercy, the less sinful we shall become inevitably. And the more filled will we be with generosity and kindness and chastity and honesty and all the other beautiful qualities which God delights to find in the hearts of His children. She composed a very balanced sentence when she wrote to Marie, "The more one is weak, without desires and without virtues, the more one is suited for the operations of His consuming and transforming love." She knew perfectly well that God's love converts us and transforms us if we give ourselves to the power of its operations. God operates in us with His grace all the time. Tout est grâce. Everything is grace. Everything. Two. 11 exclamations after that in the autobiographical manuscript. Do you remember when Therese was berating herself for falling asleep in chapel after Holy Communion? How it suddenly occurred to her, "But He can operate in me when I am asleep as well as when I am awake, the way surgeons do who put patients under anesthesia to operate on them." How imaginative she was in finding metaphors. While Therese was very far from encouraging mediocrity, at the same time she understood human weakness. What a broad-minded person she was. She had a great tolerance for our weakness and for her own. A really remarkable tolerance. She knew that in the end we are all mediocre when it comes to serving God. Doesn't Jesus tell us in the gospel to call ourselves unprofitable servants after we have done all that we could? On the same table in my room where I keep that quotation of her words to Maurice Belliere, also beautifully scripted and nicely framed, is another quotation which I often look at. This one from the diary of Raissa Maritain. Raissa was a very holy woman and a devout mystic who passed hours every day in the silent prayer which the French call oraison. These words greet me as I enter my room. In spite of all the deficiencies and all the imperfections and all the sins, let us keep afloat with confidence and by the humble and constant recognition of our own spiritual mediocrity. It would be hard to find words that are more Theresian. And they're worth putting in a nice frame. The two quotations make good friends sitting on my table. May I inject another personal note? For many years, I experienced the same sadness that Marie experienced when she received that letter from Thérèse, which became manuscript B. I would say to myself, oh yes, you talk a lot about Thérèse, and you think she's a friend of yours, which is all very well and good, but you're not so great when it comes to imitating. You talk about the little way, but how seriously do you walk on the little way? A few years ago, during a visit to Lisieux, the former mayor of the town, a marvelous gentleman, delightful man, and a great lover of Thérèse, spent a day driving me up to Alençon to see the house in which she was born and to visit other points of interest there. What a lovely medieval town Alençon is. Fortunately spared the devastating bombs which fell on Lisieux in the Allied invasion of 1945, so that the old section of Alençon is, I guess, much the same as it was in the Middle Ages. It's very quaint and delightful. The drive from Lisieux to Alençon takes, I suppose, about 2 hours. Something wonderful happened to me during that long and pleasant drive through lovely Normandy. I cannot say when, nor can I say how, nor can I say why. I only know that when I got into the mayor's car in Lisieux, my old hang-up about not being all that I should be in following Thérèse got in the car with me, and I was thinking about it off and on during the ride. And when I got out of the car in Alençon, it was gone, never to return. I simply realized from that day until this that worrying about not matching up to Thérèse is a waste of time, and it doesn't please her. As a matter of fact, in a subtle way, it is a contradiction of her little way. What needs to be said is that all the business about showers of roses, parking spaces, even getting help in moments of real desperation when you're up against it is all right when we talk about Therese, but it is not. What really matters about her? What really matters is the greatness, the unbelievable greatness of her mysticism. The radical nature of her message. What authors call the Copernican Revolution that she created in the field of religion. And the universality of her appeal. In the end, every human being is a mystic. In the end, every human being is a mystic. The baby just born an hour ago is a mystic. Because like all the rest of us who arrived in the world before he came, he can be defined as a capacity for God. That's all we are. A capacity for God. In words that have found their place among the immortal quotations of literature, St. Augustine has told us, Thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our hearts shall never rest until they rest in thee. The human heart is made for God. Every human heart. The heart of the greatest saint and the heart of the greatest sinner. And God has gifted Thérèse of Lisieux with an incomparable ability to address every human being in between the two extremes with the message of his merciful love. From the most sophisticated and intelligent to the least and most simple person in the world. Others in the long course of history have been great mystics. What sets Thérèse apart is that in addition to the depth of her mysticism, she is able to make it available to all of us who have a desire to see the mystic that is deep down within us. Other mystics will always have their readers by the tens of thousands. But Thérèse, already in the space of a single century, has her readers by the tens of millions. No one can count the number of those who have read her autobiography in the nearly 60 languages. In which it may now be found, every place on the face of the earth. Well, it's time to start to finish, or at least think of finishing. I started out by saying it would be personal, this talk. Let me end with a story that is very personal, which perhaps somebody more prudent than I would not tell about himself, but when you're my age, there's no great need to be prudent. What do you have to hide? What do you have to lose? You're going to be gone soon anyway. As the Irish say, you're fighting with your back to the sea. In March of 1947, I was transferred from a busy parish in the Bronx, which had 13,000 people going to Mass on Sunday, And can you believe it? 4,600 kids in the parochial school with 86 Dominican nuns and 24 Marist brothers teaching them, grammar school and high school. It was the largest parochial school in the United States. All of a sudden, I was assigned to our archdiocesan mission band to preach parish missions. I went to the mission band voluntarily. It was not a forced assignment, and indeed, I went eagerly. But the change proved traumatic. The sermons on the mission lasted 35 minutes, and they had to be memorized. And the rules were that you could not bring notes into the pulpit. The rules were also you couldn't use a microphone. In those days, many churches did not have microphones anyway. First of all, the talks I wrote were awful. Terrible. And I knew it. And secondly, I could not memorize a 35-minute talk. I just couldn't. But you had to stay up there in the pulpit for 35 minutes no matter what. You were not permitted to faint. My first mission was honestly a terrifying experience. Before the week was over, I was punch drunk with anxiety. I wasn't sleeping, and I was a nervous wreck. I really was frantic because I thought, I have to quit, and where do I go? Where are they going to put me? What will become of me? On the fourth night of the mission, as I got ready to go to bed, I knelt down by the side of the bed and buried my face in my hands, and I cried. I pleaded with Therese, "You have to help me. And give me a sign that you will get me through." Then I added, "If somebody gives me flowers, I'll take that as the sign." In the morning, I answered the alarm clock at 5:15 for the 6 o'clock Mass, completely forgetting that I had made that request in my night prayers. I went over to the church at 5 to 6 or so. It was locked, and the crowd of women were waiting for the sacristan to come and open it. The sacristan was an old man with an Italian accent whose name was Tony, and Tony was nowhere to be seen. At the very last minute, he came along. I can still see him, hurrying up the street with the sun rising in back of him. In his hand, he held a bunch of flowers. But I failed to make the connection. I didn't remember what I had asked for. Very impatiently, having had almost no sleep, I was irritable, I said, "Tony, will you please get the church open and put the chalice and the wine and water out? We're late." "The flowers are for you," he said. "I picked them in my garden when I was coming out of my house, and that's why I'm late." I said, "Tony, open the church." I struggled through Mass and the long instruction, and I went back to the rectory for breakfast, and all of a sudden I remembered, my God, the flowers were from Therese, and I rejected them by being so ungracious to poor old Tony. Now I'm worse off than I was before. I know that sounds crazy, but when your nerves are frayed, you lose all sense of proportion and you can't think straight. About 10 o'clock in the morning, I was back in my room trying to read the New York Times and in a terrible frame of mind over the whole disaster, when Father Jace McCarthy, who was the priest giving the mission with me, came into my room with something rolled up in a piece of waxed paper. He handed it to me with these words, "This is for yourself." I remember his exact words. When I undid the wax paper, what in the world was in it but a bunch of lilies of the valley? One of Therese's favorite flowers. How exquisitely thoughtful she is. Do give me flowers that I asked for and really desperately needed the very night before, not once, but twice, within 4 hours, probably the first time in my entire life that I ever got flowers from anybody. No wonder she's the saint for me. I so much want her to be the saint for you.